It's time for Tower Talks with Inside Towers, the wireless infrastructure industry's podcast. And here is your host, Inside Towers business editor, John Celentano.
Hello, everyone. Glad you could join us today. Tower leasing is a big topic these days. The major U.S. wireless carriers, AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile, are upgrading or modifying their master lease agreements with the big three public tower companies, American Tower, Crown Castle, and SBA Communications, as these carriers plan and implement their 5G network builds with low-band, mid-band, millimeter wave, and now C-band spectrum. T-Mobile is figuring out which of the Sprint sites it acquired that it needs to upgrade and which ones to decommission. Dish is getting ready for its network launch and has lined up more than a dozen public and private tower companies for its Open RAN sites. The big three tower cos have long-standing relationships with the major wireless carriers and cater to these carriers' near and long-term needs. However, it's usually the mid-tier and smaller tower owners and landowners that get into uncomfortable negotiations when a carrier wants to locate a tower on their tower or build a tower on their land. In these situations, what leasing terms and conditions should apply? What are the appropriate lease rates, and how are these rates determined? To help us unpack some of these issues, I'm joined today by Ken Schmidt, president of Steel in the Air. For nearly two decades, Ken has advised thousands of clients of all sizes on site lease negotiations. Ken, welcome to Tower Talks.
Good afternoon.
You know, I love that name, Steel in the Air, but you're not a structural engineer.
I am not. And if you want a quick story on that, I can do it in less than 30 seconds.
Go for it.
When we started, when I started in the industry, they were building communication towers, you know, and this was back in 97. And tower, you know, the first run of the tower companies, private tower companies, everybody was getting in. And tower companies, especially startups, were just putting dots on a map and then taking them over as their tower list, you know, to the carriers and then marketing them. And so, you know, the engineers for the carriers would go out and they'd find, you know, that there was no tower there. So they started asking the question, is there steel in the air? And so that's how, you know, when I started this company, that just seemed to be a very appropriate name.
Awesome. Good. Well, tell us about what you do and a little about on your own background in the industry.
Yeah. So I started in 97. I'm an attorney by training, but not by practice. I went to law school with a gentleman who started building communication towers in Tampa, Florida, and the surrounding area. And we grew very quickly. I think ultimately that company ended up building, and its associate companies, about 300 towers, you know, across the United States. I wasn't there that long. I stayed for about 2 years and then went out with a site acquisition vendor. So in 2004, I started Steel in the Air as the first landowner-centric national consulting firm for cell tower leases, just after having realized that there was a significant gap between what landowners knew and what the tower companies or carriers knew. Since that time, we've assisted about 4,000 clients all over the U.S. in terms of tower and lease valuations of all different types. I'm also a partner in SteelTree Partners. SteelTree Partners, with my partner Bruce Wendt, is a tower M&A advisory firm. And we brokered approximately $2.5 billion in towers over the last 20-year period as well. So,
awesome.
Yes.
So here's a scenario. I own two towers, one a monopole in a residential area of a major city. Mm-hmm. The other's a self-supporting tower near an industrial park and adjacent to a major interstate. I have a major carrier on the monopole and I'm getting good monthly rates. I've been approached by a new carrier to locate on the self-supporting tower, but they only want to pay a monthly rate that is less than half of what I'm getting from the other carrier. I want their business, but I want to be able to charge a fair rate. So what should I do?
So it really depends upon the proximity of other towers or other structures near the self-support tower. So this particular company you're referring to, you know, the hypothetical company, tends to be very cheap and thrifty in their lease negotiations, and they seem to be more willing to start at a lower rate. Most of our clients and those tower companies that I'm familiar with on the private side, you know, have been successful at negotiating slightly lower than typical lease rates for them, but they are getting more closer to, you know, the market averages for new leases of $1,750, $2,000 a month. So typically I would push back unless there are multiple choices for other towers within the close proximity to the subject tower?
They're really not, but you know, I have a site acquisition friend, and she always says, you know, the closest way to, and this is kind of like real estate appraisals, right? And the closest way to set a rate is to, you know, find out how much a two-bedroom apartment is leasing for in your area, and that's probably close, but I don't know if it's quite.
I haven't heard that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I never heard that. That's interesting.
Yeah, she seemed to feel that was not a bad metric, but you know, in terms of tower leasing trends, I mean, what are you seeing in the type of deals that you're working on? Are the rates holding at a particular, like a market level, or are they tending down? Or
no, so it depends on whether you're talking a new build-to-suit opportunity or you're talking a co-location on an existing tower.
Okay.
So certainly from the standpoint of new builds, there's a substantial amount of competition between mid-size and small tower developers for those build-to-suit opportunities. Mm-hmm. So there's much more aggressive pricing from that standpoint. So the providers are more capable of negotiating better deals on those, especially on, you know, the lead tenant on new towers.
Sure.
And co-location rates are staying fairly similar. So there, you know, there's been an attempt to reduce them, but it hasn't been that substantial.
What factors, aside from like you build a suit versus co-location, I mean, are there other influencers in how the rates are determined?
Not really. So, I mean, there, you know, with co-locations and tower, you know, tower co-location, the largest impact, you know, especially on build a suit, is the underlying ground lease.
Okay.
I mean, not all, but many of the build-to-suit contracts are based upon a certain delta above the ground rent, you know, $750 per month above the ground rent or $1,000 above the ground rent. You know, that's how these build-to-suit partners are negotiating them.
Okay.
So we're seeing, you know, obviously in areas where ground rent is more expensive or in areas where it's more costly to build a new tower, mm-hmm. The lease rates may be higher for build-to-suit opportunities. On co-locations, they seem to be more uniform. There isn't as much, you know, inflection in terms of how a tower in you know, Louisiana is compared, you know, as opposed to one in New York or whatnot, with the exception of some rural areas where land costs are significantly higher.
Mm-hmm. But this, or what the second and third tenants pay on a tower, do those rates tend to be above what the primary tenant pays? Or
absolutely, yes. Absolutely. So, you know, the you know, we're hearing, you know, lease rates, you know, that range between, you know, $1,300 a month and, you know, $2,000 a month for the build to suit, you know, mm-hmm. Anchor tenant. And mm-hmm. then, you know, upwards from there, typically no less than $1,750 and mm-hmm. you know, initially up to $2,500, even $3,000 in difficult to zone or unique areas.
So how common is it for the tower owner, I mean, to accommodate the tenant in terms of any adds or moves or changes that tenant may want to make after mm-hmm. the initial installation? Is that something that's typically built in, or is that something that's negotiated separately? How does that work?
So in the build-to-suit opportunities, it definitely is. So typically there is some type of bucket of equipment, you know, typically expressed in terms of the square inches, you know, of sale loading, you know, typically in the neighborhood of anywhere from 25,000 square inches up to, you know, 35,000, you know, plus square inches. And, you know, that's if you look at it, that's a substantial amount of equipment. It's hard for a carrier to exceed that, you know, without basically putting every huge antenna they can. On the co-location leases, there's an attempt to push that type of mentality or that type of deal structure into those, but we typically recommend against it. You know, again, unless there is some type of competing structure nearby that you're afraid that you would lose the tenant, it does not make sense to incorporate a bucket or other predefined allowed loading into the lease agreement.
It's interesting in listening to the Crown Castle call today, they referenced their revised agreement with Verizon and giving them, part of the agreement was to streamline that whole process to give them, Verizon, better opportunity to do what they need to do in terms of adding equipment on the site without getting into any kind of legalese or terms and conditions, renegotiation and the like. So I guess they figured they're going to be there for a while. So, you know, give them the latitude to do as what they need to do as quickly as possible. But
I'll point out one thing regarding that, because it does seem that in some of the answers to the questions in the earnings call, mm-hmm. you know, from the analyst, that the pricing may be more along the lines of a dedicated price per piece, you know, as opposed to an overall loading, you know, for as much equipment as you can put within that rad center. So I think that it does have a fixed component. It's just predetermined, which makes it easier for both parties not to have to negotiate, you know, each site lease amendment or supplement ad hoc.
Well, wouldn't that type of information be needed in advance anyways, just to be able to determine if they're adding loading to the tower or, by putting extra equipment?
Yes, it will be included. The question is, you know, are they getting charged a different amount depending upon the amount of equipment that's going on the tower? Or are they getting, you know, the same rate across all the towers? It sounds like to me, at least based on what I know right now, that it's more of the former.
Okay, very good. Verizon certainly is out in front with its earnestness in getting the C-band rolling. The spectrum won't even be cleared before the end of the year, and they're already, you know, buying equipment, getting ready to put it in before the spectrum can be activated. But they're ready to go.
They have both the CBRS and the C-band spectrum. Yeah. They're deploying equipment that, you know, will that presumably work for what they're calling it is anything under 6 gigahertz. So their sub six is what they're calling it. So, I mean, presumably that equipment would be able to handle, you know, anything, any of the C-bands, you know, the CBRS band, et cetera. So putting it up now, they already have the CBRS PAL licenses that they have mm-hmm. across the country. Mm-hmm. You know, they have the C-band that they, you know, so it's just a matter of being able to put it on the air and then activate it as soon as they have the licenses cleared.
I don't know how big those antennas are when they're multi-band like that. You know, they could be quite
not
sizable.
That big.
No,
they're not that big.
Huh.
Yeah, they are. You know, 30 by 25 or so. So you know, at the higher frequencies, the massive MIMO or the multi-port, multi-band mm-hmm. sub six are not that huge.
Hmm. Well, I figured they'd have a single antenna that would accommodate, you know, C-band, CBRS, and then the new proposed 3, 4, 5 gigahertz. I don't know if it would drop down to 2.5, but certainly in that 3 gig range, 3 to 4 gig range, a single antenna could be very accommodating. But and it would give them an opportunity to take some equipment down probably and put up a single multi-band antenna that'll accommodate those various frequencies. So. So would aside from the loading and the space occupancy, I mean, what other kind of terms and conditions start to come into play mm-hmm. when we're negotiating these kind of leases?
So again, on the build-to-suit, it's wide open. So, I mean, you know, we're seeing fairly egregious terms to the tower company, you know, from the wireless service providers because they're capable of getting it. They're capable of going to multiple build-to-suit partners and then, you know, jockeying for who's going to give them the best terms. And some of the negative terms that are being included, you know, include the inability to sell the site, you know, for a 10-year period. The, you know, poison pill type scenarios where you can't sell it to American Tower or a Crown Castle or an SBAC, you know, without, you know, approval from the carrier. You know, there are, you know, limited, you know, the escalations are shrinking to between, I've seen some as low as 1% per year, you know, for the build-to-suit. You know, conversely, on the co-location leases, again, the tower owner is in a better position. So what we typically recommend, I wrote down 4 specific things, one of which we've already talked about in terms of the, specific loading. Mm-hmm. You know, the first is, and I struggle with this. I don't understand why anybody agrees to it. But there should never, ever be subleasing allowed in the co-location lease. AT&T or Verizon should never be able to sublease, not that they do, but they should never be able to sublease their equipment area to somebody else going forward. So that's number one.
Are those terms built in that they want that that flexibility?
They want subleasing language. And then you think about it, especially with a lease that has the ability to, you know, for virtually unlimited amount of equipment to be added, you know, at this point, the carriers aren't sharing their rad centers, but what stops that from happening in the future? We don't know. I mean, so, you know, we don't want to be in a position as a tower owner of allowing our tenants to combine and, you know, put their equipment on rad center, one rad center, and sublease to each other, thereby cutting us out of the tower owner out of the revenue stream. That's number one. Number two, we're seeing an increase. You know, what they're trying to do is push the build-to-suit terms also in their co-location leases. And so anti-assignment language, you know, that says you can't assign this or sell it, you know, they're getting very tricky in terms of not only putting in, you know, right of first refusals, but language that allows the wireless service provider to say, no, you can't even assign this lease. So if you're selling the tower at some point in the future, conceptually, the wireless service provider could say, no, you're not going to sell it. We're not going to allow you to assign our lease. That's number two. Number three, that I think is another big one, you know, that isn't a big issue yet, but could potentially become a big issue, is the use of unlicensed frequencies. And so whether Verizon with their CBRS wants to use their PAL license and unlicensed frequencies, you know, or somebody else wants to come on the tower and use unlicensed frequencies, that's fine. As long as their use does not prohibit the tower provider or their subtenants from using similar unlicensed frequencies. Right. With licensed frequencies, it doesn't matter. They're already licensed and they're not going to interfere with each other. Right. With unlicensed, you could see where one carrier's use may prevent or make it difficult for another or even the tower owner, you know, to place unlicensed frequencies on the tower in the future.
I think WISPs are a good example. A lot of WISPs will use unlicensed frequencies, and if they're not able to get on a site that they think is strategic for them, that could be an issue.
And they're all trying to put their own anti-interference language in as well, that, you know, that prevents other companies from coming on the tower and using unlicensed frequencies. Unlicensed is exactly that. It's unlicensed. It should be able to be used as long as there is some, you know, requirement that the parties work together and try to accommodate each, you know, potential user, provided that the user that has it first on the tower has some type of priority.
Are ground leases typically separate, or can they get built into an overall master lease agreement of some sort?
They're typically separate because they're, you know, the average, you know, co-location lease is, you know, one to many, where AT&T has, you know, many leases with American Tower, many with Crown Castle and vice versa. You know, the typical land lease or a ground lease is, you know, one company has a one-to-one relationship with that landowner. There are some larger landowners that have, you know, as many as 1,000 leases that they have on their, you know, respective properties, like some of the self-storage facility, you know, owners, some of the railroads, et cetera. But for the most part, you know, there's a one-to-one type relationship. So the ground leases end up being done typically on an individual lease basis, with some cities and other larger entities having a master lease where there's, you know, master lease and then site lease supplements for each individual site.
Well, those leases would normally be between the tower owner and the landowner, would they not?
Yes, they would.
The carriers don't necessarily get involved in that.
Not unless, you know, there's still leases being done, though, between the carriers and the landowners directly.
Ah, okay.
What we are seeing, though, is that, you know, some of the, from the build-to-suit perspective, some of the carriers, you know, especially Verizon and AT&T to a certain extent as well, have decided that they would much rather control the entire process from start to permit. Mm-hmm. And then if they're going to convey it to a build-to-suit partner and enter into a build-to-suit lease with them, then they can just hand the package over, but they know that they're not adhering to the build-to-suit partner's timeline. They control it, they control the site that they want, they control everything throughout. And that's probably a better option for both parties.
Interesting, okay. We've seen the rise of disruptors in the marketplace. Have they had a big bearing on what lease rates could be charged, or to what extent do they factor into some of these negotiations between the tower companies and the carriers?
Not that much. So we think that the overall universe of these disrupting towers, those that are what we call build to reload, which are built, you know, built to relocate.
Right.
You know, they're built adjacent to existing towers with the express purpose of moving a tenant from an existing tower over to the new tower. we think the universe of that is about 2,000 towers. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when there's, you know, approximately 175,000 towers, it's not insignificant, but it's still less than 1%. True. Of the over, just slightly over 1% of the entire market. Mm-hmm. You know, the public tower companies have been pretty effective at entering the new master lease agreements. And those master lease agreements, just like the Verizon one with Crown Castle that just went and entered into, extended the term to 10 years.
Right.
American Tower extended their average term with T-Mobile to 15 years. Mm-hmm. Those were all done specifically, you know, at that length of time to make sure that the tenant had very little incentive to move to a new tower. So I think that there's definitely been a slowdown in terms of the disruptors, in terms of the mm-hmm. number of towers that are being constructed. Mm-hmm. As there were in the beginning. The other issue is that there's only so much low-hanging fruit where, you know, the cost of building a new tower is easy, you know, simple or less. The, you know, you're in a rural area where there's no zoning and it's easy mm-hmm. to move. And, you know, with each of these master leases being put in place, it just becomes more and more difficult mm-hmm. for you to get that second tenant on the tower. Mm-hmm. And at the rates these disruptors are charging and the lease terms that they're granting, they have to have a second tenant to really make those things viable.
Sure. Yeah, these master lease agreement revisions seem that they, you know, it's kind of a win-win for the tower company and the carrier, right? It over time it gives the carrier favorable terms, if not lower rates or maybe lower escalators. I don't know, but it just strikes me that you know, these guys have got it all worked out. That they both come away feeling pretty good about it, you know. Good.
Yes.
One type of deal that we've seen recently, and you mentioned it before in our previous talk about sale leasebacks, and the example that has come up in recent times is the Pacific Gas and Electric and SBAC getting together, and Pacific Gas and Electric selling off assets to SBAC and then SBAC leasing back to them. Is that a kind of an outlier, Ken, or do you think that type of arrangement could show up a little more often going forward?
I think that it starts to show up more often. It is somewhat of an outlier still. You know, these types of agreements are being done because the traditional tower acquisition of large, you know, scale in terms of the number of towers just isn't there. Carrier portfolios are all, you know, pretty much purchased up, with the exception of some outliers for those carriers, you know, with the exception of US Cellular. And so far, US Cellular isn't selling. So there aren't any sizable portfolios of towers to be acquired. And for a company like SBAC, you know, or Crown Castle, to a lesser extent, American Tower, you know, that really build themselves on acquisitions, you know, they don't really have much choice in terms of extending the purview of what they think of a typical transaction. So I think what I equate this to is more, you know, that we're getting closer to this hybrid of a lease buyout, where they're just purchasing the lease and they, you know, collect the revenue off of it, and that of purchasing a tower. And the PG&E portfolio sits somewhere in the middle of that.
Okay.
PG&E isn't selling the actual physical structures to SBAC. Mm-hmm. They're selling the rights to be able to use them. They sell the marketing rights, and that right, on, right. You know, they sell the current revenue, which is the, you know, the leases that are on those structures. Mm-hmm. They sell the marketing rights and the management rights going forward, but on a unknown revenue share, you know, for other PG&E assets. It's a good portfolio. So, you know, I think that from a location and other standpoint, it's well positioned, especially in California, which is notoriously difficult for zoning, et cetera. So it's in a good position, you know, to see upside and growth. The only hesitancy that I have and that I'm concerned with is that we dealt with in the past, you know, major railroads, you know, the public transportation authorities, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. utilities, you know, we dealt with a number of those over the course of our consulting guidance for similar landowners. And the engineers tend to run the show. So from the standpoint that it sounds great that, you know, we all want to make the additional revenue on these particular sites, but when it comes down to the individual site and the engineer that's reviewing the documents and saying, look, I don't want to have to deal with anything over the, you know, over the top of the upper power line. I don't want to have to, you know, have somebody shut down their equipment to go work on my site. then it's an entire different story. So the key for SBA and the success of this type of transaction is really critical. It's primarily based upon their success in negotiating in that master lease agreement some very clear restrictions and guidelines on when PG&E can reject a site and when they can't. And that will see, that will show us how much of the upside is.
Yeah, they're just getting started with that. We haven't really seen any kind of transactions, at least that I'm aware of. But I guess once the agreements are in place, then they can go forth, right?
Yep, go forth and start marketing them. Yeah, we've seen similar stuff with some of the railroads, Diamond Communications and some of the others that formed management agreements with, the railroads or other companies. American Tower, one of their earlier transactions, was the deal that they worked out with the post office to be able to put towers on, every post office in the U.S. So these types of transactions are out there. The major difference, though, is they purchase the cash flow from the existing leases and the management rights, as part of the overall deal.
Excellent. Well, this has been great, Ken. We learn something every time we talk. So any closing remarks you'd like to leave us with?
It's going to be a great year. Forward from, just the amount of activity, we're busier than we've been in a long time. Yep. The amount of activity from Verizon, from T-Mobile, early starts for Dish, very early starts, and very limited, activity from AT&T, which should accelerate based on their capital expenditure plans for the year. I shudder to think of how much activity there's going to be for all of us and how we're all going to handle it.
That's what you call a high quality problem, right?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, even our own analyses projecting what the capital spend might be just on the wireless side shows and we know from what Verizon has already guided to, they're adding an incremental $2 to $3 billion just in this year alone for their C-band deployment. So yeah, I'm with you. We're in a good space right now.
We are in a good space.
How can interested parties contact you regarding your leasing advisory services if they wish?
Sure. So steelinthear.com, steelinthear.com. There's plenty of resources on there, question and answers, contact pages, and a lot of information. That'd be the first place. And then if anybody's interested in the brokerage or sell side advisory standpoint for tower assets, that's steeltreepartners.com.
Great. Well, thanks, Ken, for your time and your insights. And thanks to everyone who joined in on the conversation today. Stay tuned for the next Tower Talks episode and enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you for listening to Tower Talks. To subscribe to our podcast, our daily newsletter, or use our other industry resources, please visit InsideTowers.com. Until next time, you've been listening to Tower Talks from Inside Towers, the wireless infrastructure industry's podcast.